Welcome to the Dark Zone, an adventure racing podcast.
I love candy. I love candy, but the longer the race is, the more you need Whole Foods. So I like a meatball sub sometimes. I'll pack like half a meatball sub, and 6 hours into the race, for whatever reason, I'll destroy a meatball sub.
Okay, you people sit tight, hold the fort, and keep the home fires burning. And if we're not back by dawn, call the president.
You're going the wrong way!
What?
You're going the wrong way!
He says we're going the wrong way!
Oh, he's drunk! How would he know where we're going?
Yeah, how would he know?
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
This episode of The Dark Zone is being brought to you by Pack Rafting Adventures. Hike, paddle, explore. Delivering pack rafting adventures to the eastern United States, Pack Rafting Adventures offers skills in river safety courses, guiding, rentals, and pack raft races. From beginner level instruction to comprehensive guiding and trip planning services for experienced outdoor adventures, they have something for you. Let them help you discover the joy of pack rafting. And don't forget about their upcoming event, the Eastern Mountain Wilderness Challenge, being held August 10th and 11th, 2024. Check out their website at www.packraftingadventures.com. That's right, one word, packraftingadventures.com. Good luck out there. Exciting news from our episode sponsor, Ascend Athletics. This spring, Ascend will be celebrating the relaunch of their nine-year-old program in Afghanistan and the one-year launch into Pakistan. Through sports and leadership training, Ascend has been reshaping educational and career opportunities for girls in these regions, championing gender equality, and creating a future where girls in society can thrive. Each girl Ascend supports becomes a door for many other girls, and this year they're aiming to reach even more. Ascend will be holding their second annual Hike for Her event in Virginia on June 1st, 2024. Visit the Hike for Her page at www.ascendathletics.org/attendevents, that's one word, to learn how to register. Remember, Ascend is an international organization, so you don't have to be local to join in. You can become a sponsor or even create your own team from afar and hike for her on your local trails. And as a reminder, Ascend pays nothing for the sponsorship. We're happy to host them and to spread the word of their good work. Welcome to the Dark Zone Adventure Racing Podcast. This is your host, Brian Gatens. Today, we're joined by Nick Herf. Nick is the race director for Rev3 Racing. We invited them on the show to talk about their upcoming races like the New River Rush, the DMV, all part of the ARWS Regional Series, as well as a new race that he's developing with Jesse Tubb as an adaptive sports adventure race, which is the first time I've heard about that. And we'll get that during the podcast today. Nick, thanks for coming on the show. Great to have you here. Before we get into those races themselves, tell us a bit about yourself, because you're a pretty successful adventure racer yourself.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, I've been adventure racing for a few years now. I did pretty well last year. I did my first Expedition 5-day race up in Canada, which was a great experience. And I've done a variety of, you know, 3-day to, you know, 12-hour races. But yeah, I've been doing well. I wound up, I think, ranked number one for a few months in the individual power rankings, which is pretty cool. Definitely don't think I was that good, but it was pretty cool to be having some fun there. So
I tell you, sort of dry. I was ranked number one, but I'm not that good. So don't worry about me. Well, before we get into that, tell us about your race in Canada. Who'd you race with?
So I raced with Team Peak Pursuit.
Okay.
So Brian Kwiatkowski is their main navigator. He's phenomenal. Phenomenal individual, great leader. And he roped a couple of us in where it was our first expedition races. And we had a great time. It was just out there to have fun.
And which race was that? Was that Expedition Canada?
It was, correct.
It was. And how did that, you know, we're adventure racing podcast. You roped into it, your first 5-day race. How did you guys do overall?
We did decent. I think we came in like six or so, but yeah, it was a great experience. So we went in there with the attitude that we're just going to go have fun. We'll push, but, you know, come out as friends, and it worked really well.
What was your biggest thing that you learned during the race?
Biggest thing I learned during the race. I would say the topography lines on the map can be very different. So I think there were 30 meter contour intervals on some of the maps. Right. So you're standing on a big mountain on a ridge and you're looking down like, oh, this ridge, that ridge are all the same ridge on the map, which is pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. The big expedition race, the large scale maps mm-hmm. make it challenging because you learn a lot about the race course, but not a lot about exactly where you're standing. So that's a big exactly. part of it too. Right. How'd you do with the sleep and the nutrition?
I think we did pretty well. We did pretty well. I mean, everybody had high spots, low spots, but overall I think we did decent on it. Worked pretty well there.
The trick there is don't have the low spots all at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And we didn't. So it wound up working really well.
It's great you had a good experience at Expedition Canada. Now you live in this world, don't you? What do you do for a living?
Yeah. So for a living, I'm in the strength and conditioning field. So I'm the director of sports performance at Alvernia University in Pennsylvania. So I oversee the sports performance of the 30 NCAA and intercollegiate teams. So strength and conditioning, nutrition, performance psychology. I also teach there for their Masters of Athletic Training program on an evidence-based performance enhancement course. It's like a lab science type of a course. And additionally, I train endurance athletes on the side. And so that's kind of been something I've been doing for a while.
You mentioned that you work with endurance races. Were you connected with Hunter Leininger in his recent FKT across Florida?
Yes, I was. So I've been coaching Hunter for probably about a year and a half now, I guess. And Hunter's great. So for his FKT, he went to attempt the Florida Trail FKT, which is 1,110 miles. And I went down there for about 11 days. He brought me down out of the 22 and a half days it took him to complete it. And so the record's still pending review, but it should go through. And it was terrific to be there with him and support him.
Tell us about the New River Rush and the DMV. When are those races and what can the racers expect?
Yeah, so the DMV adventure race is April 6th at Lee Sylvania State Park. So it's on the Potomac near Virginia. And that race is going to be a 12-hour and 4-hour. And what's neat there is you're going to be connecting some different locations along the Potomac that you may not normally think to connect, which is pretty awesome. And so we're pretty excited about it. You're going to get some really nice flowy mountain bike trails, which is going to be terrific. Some good O courses and a decent amount of paddling too. The paddling won't be too crazy, but it'll be good open water paddling. And so we're excited about that. And then the New River Rush is May 17 to 19. So we have a 50-hour and a 12-hour race that weekend. It's out of Ace Adventure Resort down in the New River Gorge. And so that one it's very similar to the Wild and Wonderful that Ronnie and Adventure Odyssey used to run. So we actually contacted them. And it's funny how that came up. I was talking to Mike Spiller, who owns Rev3, and I was like, hey, the New River is great. I've been there. It's a blast. Why don't we do a race there? He said, well, they used to run one. Let's reach out and see if they're running it again. They weren't. They're open to us running it. And so I'm pretty excited for that race. So it's going to be a blast. It's going to start with guided whitewater rafting. And then from there, I scouted a lot of different old mine shafts and really cool things. So decent elevation gain on that one. However, anytime you have to hit elevation gain, there's some cool vistas or views or interesting things that you're going to see. So I'm really excited for that race.
So it sounds like, if I look at the two races, 4-hour, 12-hour for DMV, 12-hour, 50-hour for the New River Rush. So it sounds like if someone's sitting at home right now, if they're a beginning adventure racer, they could clearly take a shot at the 4 hours, maybe upgrade to the 12 hours. But if they've been doing 12-hour races, they could upgrade themselves to the 50-hour race. It sounds like there's a really lot of nice offerings for Rev3.
Correct. Yes. And the 50-hour race last year we ran kind of down in the Shenandoah Valley area. The idea with the 50-hour this year is that we want to challenge the top teams with pro points. So similar to what you've seen a lot of other races do. However, the short course options for the teams are still going to take you to some pretty cool vistas and allow you to experience the course. So if you're an average team, this is going to be a great race. If you're a slower team, you'll still come out. You'll get to see large parts of the course and have a really good time as well.
So let's connect your two worlds together here, right? Someone's listening to the podcast right now and they want to level up. They want to become a stronger racer. They want to try a bigger venue, a bigger event, and they need to train for that. They need to get ready for that. What are your big broad pieces of advice that you would say to people at home right now who want to go for a bigger race distance?
Yeah, I would say don't be intimidated by a bigger race. You can always move slower as long as you're generally making progress and getting the nutrition and then training for it. A lot of the AR community has tons of great coaches out there. So I coach Jared Schumacher. I was working with recently with Hunter Leninger. He coaches and works with AR Georgia. I know the Magnuses. You got a whole bunch of coaches out there that you can reach out to. And getting a coach helps you, because what it does is it allows you to maximize your time that you have available to train. So all of us have day jobs. We all have things we got to do. And so a coach helps you with the accountability, but helps you just use your time in a way that fits with your lifestyle to help you achieve your goals. And so I would say that if you aren't looking at a coach, other ways you can train is just really do a little something every day. So even if you only have 20 minutes, going out for 20 minutes helps a lot with endurance training, because it's metabolic. So you just get the metabolism firing, get the aerobic system moving or the anaerobic system even for 20 minutes, and that helps. And then on the weekends, if you have time, go for a bigger effort. And those are just, that's just a great general strategy. You can also alternate between running and biking, and maybe get a little bit of lifting, paddling, or swimming in. They all kind of use upper back strength. And that's another way you can do it. If you alternate them, you're probably not going to overdo anything. And that's just a good general trend to go with.
Yeah. That's when I had Jesse Spangler on the show one time, I asked him about his own, very, very fast, Jesse. And, you know, it appears if you're in the sport, you name Jesse, you're fast. You got Spangler, you got Tubb, right? That's the trick is, the trick is be named Jesse. And the one thing that he talked about was that while he does train and he trains a lot, he says for him, the idea of it's being consistent over time is to get out there every single day as much as you can. If it's 20 minutes, 20 minutes, but don't take off long periods of time off in a row. Another piece of advice that I've heard from I believe it was also Spangler that said this too. I apologize if I'm mixing up the feedback I got, was to definitely try to do things with a map in your hand as much as possible. That orienteer.co is a very popular website that's growing in terms of making your own courses. And the idea of like practicing moving your body, as well as the mental part of having a map in your hand, those two things. Now, if I remember correctly, you had a really good result this year at Rootstock Racing's the Stockville. Am I correct?
I did. I don't remember where I came out, but I know I did well in the solo category and maybe fifth or sixth overall. I don't quite remember.
I think so. For some reason, three's ringing in my head, but I could be wrong, right? I mean, but I think you did very well there. Talk to us a bit about the challenges that you found with navigation. How did you get better being a navigator? Did you race with a team? Did you do it on your own? Did you go to clinics? Like map, you know, it's one thing when you race with a team and you have a map in your hand because you have other people to talk to. When you race solo with a map in your hand, it's me, myself, and I, right? You're all by yourself. So how do you do that so well?
Yeah, I love racing solo for that challenge. I like racing with people as well. Like the team aspect is great. Every now and then I like to race solo for that, just independent. For me, navigation started back in college years ago. So I went to school in Pennsylvania, played college soccer, and I had a ROTC scholarship. And we had our ROTC program was at a Lehigh University. We had a mountain and a small mountain with a big state park up top and wooded. And we did a lot of navigation there, just land navigations, what the military calls it, orienteering, same thing. And we would do it day and night. At night, you couldn't use any lights. It was just pure dark, and you'd have to get really good at both terrain association and, you know, navigating there. And so with that, I went through Ranger School and was an infantry officer for a while, did some special operations things in Afghanistan and whatnot. And just through all of those progressions, you become pretty good at navigating both, you know, moving in vehicles as well as dismounted on the ground. And so when I came into adventure racing, my foundation was pretty good. However, just getting out there and experiencing it and getting the rust off and learning skills is great. Mark Latanzi's book is phenomenal, Squiggly Lines. So if you haven't read that, that's a great read. It really hits everything from the basics to some details and really makes it well. And then the best way is just getting out there and getting some orienteering in. Little orienteering meets are a fantastic way to do it. And so the more you do it, the more you learn and you find times to do different skills. So for example, at Stockville, I was going for one of these, it was on the kind of the side edge of a hilltop on this long ridge I was coming around. And I knew I was generally around the right elevation, but I wasn't sure where the angle was. So I did some resections off of mountains in the distance that were on the map and could tell, oh, I'm off a little bit, and was able to backtrack and get there. And the more you have the skills, eventually you start to play them in. And if you can race with better navigators, you learn stuff too. Yeah. So, you know, you just see the way that you would attack a point. You see the way they would attack a point. And all of a sudden you realize like, oh, they're just going to aim for this creek and handlebar the creek up or whatever it is. And it works really well.
Yeah, it's I agree with you. Well, first things first, thank you for your service. I didn't realize that you're former military. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, yeah.
We appreciate your service. I appreciate the fact that Uncle Sam got you into navigation, right? We're all benefiting right now. So thank you very much. But you're right. I think navigation is one of those things that people who are new at it, who aren't that good at it, they think that those who are good at it were kind of just born that way. That somehow they magically are good navigators. And I think what you're saying and what I've seen and what I've learned is that, and this isn't rocket science, you get better at navigating by navigating and by being in a race. And I do agree with you. I think the biggest secret that's out there is that if you want to get better at navigation, orienteering clubs have these great meets. Usually they're in parks, they're smaller, they're not these massive events. You can go do one in a morning, either a formal event where you go, you register and you get a map right there. Or if you look online, there are these maps that exist and it might be these permanent orienteering courses and you get out there and you put a map. And I think that having the ability to think in three dimensions and think spatially and have a map in your hand makes you just such a better adventure racer because you're spending less mental energy trying to figure out where to go. That you kind of just know, like, here's this body of water, here's this creek, here's this ridge's reentrant, and you're going in the proper direction. It also teaches you that it's not about error avoidance, but error correction and getting better at that. When you were racing in Stockville or the races you've done, how often do you have to reconsider your navigation lines? Or are you pretty much bing, bing, bing?
Actually, several times a race. Like, it's, you know, there's times where you're very spot on. You're following on the map. You know where you're at. You're going, you're going, you're going. And then all of a sudden, it says there's times where the map doesn't match the ground. And so, you know, the topography is your number one thing that generally doesn't change. However, the roads, the trails, all those things can. And so there's several times where in a race, most of the maps are from like 1983 or 84, a lot of them. So things change. And so as you're going along, there's many times in a race where you realize like, okay, this isn't right. Let me take a look. And I think exactly what you said is the better you become at navigation, the more quickly you realize when you're off. And so it's not a, 30 minutes later, I realized I'm off. It's 2 minutes, 5 minutes, I realized I'm off. And now I can quickly re-glue, maybe backtrack, double check. And that's kind of a big thing is how quickly can you identify the mistakes? Because everybody makes mistakes in the navigation piece.
Coming back to the races, I'm really curious about how you, as a race director, how do you find that experience, right? It's one thing to be a racer, it's one thing to be sports and conditioning, but to be a race director feels like a big thing. How's the race directing treating you so far?
It's great. I enjoy it. The race directing, you definitely get a new view on a lot of aspects of the race experience. However, coming from kind of the military background and planning a lot of operations, large scale, there's a lot of similarities which carry over. So working with outside organizations, entities, permitting, risk mitigation, I mean, all those things, tracking people, a lot of that is similar. But there are nuances which are different. And so for Rev3, you know, Mike Spiller, who owns the company, has been doing a great job of mentoring me on the adventure racing and aspects from the director perspective. And then talking with other race directors who are out there has been excellent as well. I would say the most rewarding part of being a race director is watching the racers experience the course you set. And when you're creating it, you're thinking about what they're going to experience. And then watching them do it is great. I would say a parallel between what I do career field wise with my coaching and what I do with race directing and adventure racing is the ability to have newer individuals realize self-efficacy is the biggest thing. So you come out of it and you can see people who've pushed themselves and who are experiencing this whole new world or pushing limits and coming out of there feeling more confident. And the same thing in the weight room. I see that in the weight room, speed, agility, all of that with my athletes as well. I get, you know, freshmen in who over the course of a couple months become stronger, they become more confident, they start fitting in with their teams, they gain that really just that self-efficacy that they can work hard and achieve things. And it's really rewarding as a coach and a race director.
It's a very, very powerful, almost spiritual experience when you're in the presence of somebody who realizes that they have potential and they could be more and they could do more and they could, and they've set these limits for themselves, and they realize that through a combination of their effort, being in the right place, right time, mentorship, coaching, and guts on their part, that they could be so much more than that. And I think we're seeing it in different places, right? You see it in your work life. I see it in my work life, but also as a race director, you see it on a grand scale, because someone shows up to your race and they don't know if he or she, if they could actually complete the race, if they could do well. And then you see them at the finish line and it's two different people.
Exactly. And that's part where I saw, when I first raced a Rev 3 race, I saw Mike, who's the race director, and Christy out on the course checking in with racers. And they're checking in with the racers who are the middle of the pack to end of the pack and encouraging them to go on. You know, hey, if you're feeling this way, why don't you just stop, take 5 minutes, get some food. They'll talk to them for a bit. Next thing you know, they're back pushing again. And really, I think quality race directors are really focused on the new racers and their race experience, but it comes from a place of just care and, just care for the individuals who are out there.
Thomas, who's the race director for the One Water race, Thomas Ogander, a great interview. And he talked about it, how in his race, and these were my words, but I'll paraphrase what he was saying. My take was he wants the race to be challenging, but not cruel. He doesn't want people, like, he wants people to work hard and to put the effort into the race and to be challenged and to really have to push themselves, but not to create a meat grinder situation where he put people into that are too hard for them, that are dangerous. Like, races that are run well are not human meat grinders. We don't want to do that to people. And I think you're right about that, that it's the race director's responsibility to find that special, that balance in between just hard enough and yet hard enough that they could either meet those expectations or exceed them and they don't get blown out the back, but they have to work along the way. Right. And that's the magic of being a race director.
100%. And it sometimes can be difficult. It sometimes can be difficult because the gap between some of the elite racers that'll come out and your average racer is pretty drastic.
Yep.
And so trying to bridge that gap with course design and how you design it, you know, the Pro Points format that several race directors are using now, I think is an excellent way to do that. Trying to create that course is challenging, but very important.
We always mention the tail of the race. Like, I've been involved in a lot of 5-day races as a racer and as a volunteer. And I know, like, when I was involved with the Endless Mountains with Rootstock Racing, the tail of the race, right? The very first team and the team that was towards the back, how spread out were they along the course, right? That was always the challenge there. And as a race director, you have to make decisions about getting the equipment ahead, moving bicycles forward, getting the boats there. And that's where it gets really hard. Some races, super long. Some races, not so much. Coming back to One Water race, it's a 63-hour race that Thomas puts on. His rule is that if you are more than 8 hours behind the leader, you're out. Like, it's not where you are on the course. It's like if they're that far up the water on you, then your race is over. I thought that was an interesting way of doing that. And we don't want to, that's a pro race, basically. We don't want to start pulling racers, you know, amateur racers off of courses. But that was the rule of thumb that he followed. But I do think you're spot on when you talk about that good race directors are focused on getting people to the finish line. And they want them to do well, and they want to encourage them and, you know, have a little snack, catch your breath. And I've even seen race directors say to struggling teams, like, let's look at the maps together a little bit. And here's where you are. Like, what are we going to go and how are we going to do this? Because you want people to leave the race feeling good about themselves. Talk nice about the race too, right? You don't want people to go home and complain and carry on. And so that's part of it also.
Exactly. And one way we design a lot of courses or the way that I've done it is, I like the choose your own adventure style, which is what kind of those Pro Point formats allow, because you can choose that. And so often in my pre-race briefings, I'll give some information on the course as far as, hey, if you're really into single track, these areas and trails here are phenomenal. There's really good scenic overlooks at these points. If you want to stay flatter, this area here has less elevation gain. And so it allows the racers to be more informed when choosing their adventure. And so the idea is that it allows them to have a better experience. And then obviously those elite racers, they're going to cover the whole course. And so, you know, if there's a part of the course where it's like, hey, there's just hurricane wind blown stuff all over, like, you let everybody know and generally avoid it. However, the elite racers, letting other racers know those parts isn't going to impact their race at all. But at the same time, the bulk of the racers are going to benefit from that in getting a little bit more detail on how they want to choose their adventure.
There was a third race before we came on the air. We talked a little bit about it, but I definitely don't want to get too deep into the podcast before we begin to bring it up. On July 14th, Jesse Tubb and yourself are working on an adaptive sports adventure race. Tell us a bit about that.
Correct. Yeah. So Jesse had this idea to put on a adventure race for adapted sport, and he's reached out to myself and a couple others about it. I've raced with Jesse, actually, and he's phenomenal. Great person. And what's interesting is for my master's, I had actually wrote a paper on putting on an adventure race for adapted sport. So when he had mentioned it on the phone call with me, I was like, hey, I actually have a paper, emailed it to him right away. He read it, and instantly we were kind of on that same page. And so Jesse's spearheading it with a lot of us coming in to support him. The races for it's adapted sport. So individuals with disabilities, whether it's behavioral, cognitive, or physical, this race is designed for you. So it's adapted to allow them to pick their adventure. It's going to be hosted July 14th at Patapsco State Park in Maryland. We're looking for volunteers to come out and help, and even adventure racers who want to come out and pair up with teams to help on the course. And we're also partnering with Walter Reed Army Hospital, as well as Kennedy Krieger Institute, who are coming in to help us advise, because this is the first time we're doing this. So if you do have expertise in the area, let us know as well. We're looking at right now, tentatively, a 3-hour race. We think that's a really good point to where it allows the race to go on, but not too long to where, keep it short and sweet. And then the format is kind of a pick your own adventure. So the idea is you can get any checkpoint any way you want. We're not paddling on this one. It just makes it more simple logistically for everything. And it's going to be a great time.
I think that's first off, compliment to you. I think for all the races that I've heard about, all the races that I've done and I've seen, the idea of there being a dedicated adaptive sports adventure race, I compliment you and Jesse and everyone who's getting involved in that. And I know the work of Walter Reed with our veterans, and I know the work of Kennedy Krieger, a friend of mine's son, had the opportunity to work with that incident, with that group. Really a compliment to all of you, but a challenge, right? Because because adventure racing is hard by nature. And so adaptive is adaptive. I've had the chance to work with the Challenge Athletes Foundation in New York City.
Okay.
My buddy Jim and I, and many of us, his wife Kate and my son Jimmy and a whole pack of us, we work with challenged athletes who might possibly have prosthetic help. They may possibly be in a wheelchair. There might be cognitive, behavioral challenges that they're having. And we help them get through the course. Tall order, a lot to do. What challenges are you finding for the adaptive sports AR that you're now, first things first, you haven't done it yet, right? So you know the challenges after it's over, right? But
yes,
going into it, how are you adapting it? You mentioned you're staying off the water, right? Not a bad idea, right? Mm-hmm. Because water, as we all know, is challenging in many ways. The length of the race is 3 hours. Are you adapting? Like, are you giving larger maps? Are the maps going to be adaptive to individuals with visual issues, things like that? Or are you waiting to see the clientele and then you're going to build the course around it?
So the course, what we're doing is we're kind of keeping it a broad range that we can predict and allow that to happen. So the location we chose has some adapted trails already, which helps there. So the location's good. We're choosing areas that also have paved areas as well. And we're doing a variety of tiers of difficulty of the points, because difficulty can vary greatly based on the individual. Mm-hmm. And so a big way that we're alleviating some of the issues is by allowing any point in any way you want. So you can, again, choose your own adventure. So that way individuals can challenge themselves as much or as little as they need to, and provide a whole menu of options on how they want to do that. I would say one issue that we're trying to work through is awards, and how we want to do that. Do we do category awards? Do we not? What are the categories? Some of the Paralympic sport categories can help cross over, but trying to work through a lot of the minutiae with that is challenging. So if anybody is very experienced there or has great ideas, shoot us an email and let us know.
Yeah, I know from my experience with the Challenge Athletes Foundation that the award structures are very complicated in terms of the, because you're you're adapting the awards to the people's individual challenges, and so it gets really hard there. But to your credit, to your point, this is a race. There's going to be awards. Yeah. There's going to be winners. Like, people are coming out there. It's not an exhibition. It's the course is going to be open. People will race for 3 hours. We'll see how they do on the podium. I look forward to hearing about that race. And obviously, when we, as it gets closer, we do support it. Let's let the Dark Zone know. Absolutely. We're more than happy to support that.
100%.
So you got a lot going on, right? You have your primary work and your job. You have your RD work. You have your own racing. You have all the things that you're putting together here. How do you keep all the balls in the air?
I guess just time management's a big piece.
That being said, what is your own training like?
My own training? Yeah. So I actually have a coach myself. Mm-hmm. So I think everybody benefits from a coach. And so the coach I have is actually a trail running coach. His name's David Roche. He has the SWAT podcast. He writes, you've probably read articles in Outside World or, you know, Running Magazine, a lot of those. But he's phenomenal. So my training involves a lot of running and biking. I mean, pretty simple. And then the cross training for lifting and paddling and stuff I do on my own. However, his stuff's terrific. So right now, today I have a 14-mile run. It'll be a variety of intensities. Yesterday I had easy 6 miles with some hill intervals. I had 3x5 minute hill work the other day after it was about 11 and a half miles total with 3x5 minutes in there. I mean, it's a mix of threshold intensity with a lot of baseline. Your typical programming is going to be that way. So a lot of individuals hear about the 80-20. That's pretty good. And it's just in general, the bulk of your training is light and easy. However, you increase intensity. And depending on the individual, you'll vary it. So a lot of research shows that female endurance athletes need more intensity than male athletes based on their muscle fiber typology and some of their metabolic processes. And then, the periodization is very customized for the individual, which is awesome. So again, I use a coach. I absolutely love it. And I recommend everybody, if you have the feasibility to, it is fantastic.
Years ago, when I was more of a cyclist, I worked with a cycling coach, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. There were two things that existed there. First things, it was very good for me to outsource my brain to somebody else.
Yes. Right?
My coach did all the thinking for me, right? And so the plan would arrive on a Sunday night, and I would have the week laid out in front of me. And all I had to worry about was doing that thing that he gave me. And it was very nice waking up in the morning knowing that this was the thing for the day and then building your life around it. That's one part of it, too. The second part, too, is that the fact that it just took care of the time, that I didn't have to spend any time trying to figure things out. It was just there waiting for me. And then I've gone to the no coach philosophy, which will only carry you so far. Mm-hmm. What's funny is you what's the expression? The person who's his own coach has a fool for a client. Like, I just, like, you need to go to somebody else and have that taken care of. People want to go back in the Dark Zone archives. Jenny Seeger, who's a very popular coach, she's been on the show twice, Siegs. She's a very, very strong coach, very, very popular with many different racers. So, but I do agree with you. There's a lot of good people out there to talk to. And I think if you have the capability to do it, I also think too that while there's a cost involved with it, and coaching is not free, nor should it be free, I found that is well spent money when it comes to my enjoyment of the sport. Whereas if I'm kind of roaming around out there on my own and I'm aimless, it tends to not work out so well.
Exactly. I agree. And Jen has a great reputation. I've talked to several, I know several people who use her, and she's fantastic. I met her briefly at Canada as well. So fantastic racer. And for me, I fall into these traps where I can justify changing my workouts because I know all the, you know, oh, well, this will do this adaptation or whatever. And for me, it's like having the accountability piece is key for me.
Well, knowing that another person is looking at your file.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I can't skip out on this.
So talk to me a bit about the team dynamic. You mentioned that things went well in Expedition Canada. People had high points, you had low points. How do you, and especially with your military background and the fact that that's team in the greatest sense of the word, what mental attitude do you bring to a team-based activity that lets it go successfully?
I would say just working on the team dynamic. So you come in there with a positive attitude and listening to each other and just trying to problem solve together. And so a big part of some of the elite units I've worked with, is that the ego piece is put in check. And so that's secondary to everything else. And so you come in there, creative, collaborative, and you hold each other's standards, and the standards are there. But when somebody's struggling, somebody's doing this, you're the first one to help them out because it's all about the team. And also putting into putting in its place that we're out here to have fun. And so if it's coming to a point to where whatever expectations we have are unrealistic, then we adapt what those are in order to keep the team together and keep things going well, right? At the end of the day, we're all going to be friends. So if the race isn't working in the way we want, instead of getting frustrated with each other and taking it out on each other, we instead, you know, change our expectations. It's about the team and about each other.
Gotcha. And the other part too is being a teammate and the expectations in that is one of my earliest interviews on the Dark Zone with Sarah Goldman. And she talked about how a great way to be a good teammate is to show up and be ready. That you're sending the message to your teammates, like my gear is sorted, my capacity is good, the dogs are barking, like all of that stuff. Yeah. Like that's so that was the point that Sarah made, was that you have to show up there as like as someone who's ready to race, and you're sending a nonverbal message to your teammates that you're ready to go. And as a result, they have faith in you, have faith in them.
100%. Yeah. And that mutual trust is critical. And you hear stories. I haven't really encountered, I've been fortunate that I've had really good teammates in all my races. And sometimes there's differences in skill level or ability, but I very rarely, actually I've had a few where there've been expectations have been misaligned. But in general, I've had really good teammates, which I've been fortunate about. And it's about everybody just coming together and showing up, like you said.
I think on the expectation setting, it's good to have that conversation prior to the race starting, right? Mm-hmm. So because when you're in the race setting itself and you're tired and you're hungry and you're fatigued and you're what's going on, that's a tough time to make those decisions. And so maybe you say to yourself, like, here's the maps. We need to be at checkpoint X by this time. If not, we need to be considered cutting parts of the course. Because if you get it's really tough to say during a race, well, maybe we need to shorten the course when you're in the race itself, because mm-hmm. some teammates might feel that you could travel slower, you could travel faster. The races that have gone the most south for me are races in which we attempted to make high stakes decisions in high pressure environments. And then things tend to fall apart because if someone's hungry or they're tired, the whole place just, the whole team just comes apart at the seams.
100%. And that's where for Hunter's FKT attempt, we had a lot of those conversations prior. If this happens, if that happens, what are we doing? Are we pushing here? Are we not pushing there? And we come up with criteria. And that's something similar that Dave Ashley, who's been on the show, he just mm-hmm. set the 50 peaks. So the highest peak in each of the 50 mm-hmm. states world record. Mm-hmm. Actually, he used my consulting services a few times with that. I know Dave, I've raced with him. With mountaineering, which Dave is really big in, it's the same thing. Prior to going up on Denali or a big mountain, you have decision points and you have those likely scenarios and contingencies, and you try to plan out as much as you can. So in the moment, the decision making isn't needed. And all the emotions that you may feel at the time are not a factor in the decision because the decision's black and white. And so that's kind of one aspect where I see a parallel kind of in all areas, the mountaineering side, the adventure racing. If, you know, I have an athlete who's going on a very big effort or they have an injury previously that, you know, they're unsure about, we can have those conversations and determine what the most tangible criteria, like objective criteria, are the best way to go into making decisions.
Yeah, I had a chance. Dave was Dave, Shelley Johannesson, Jim Murn, and I raced in Faroe Islands this past summer. We had a great race, a lot of fun. Interesting dynamic that they'd raced together and Jimmy and I had raced together, but we were a unit of four for the first time. And it took us like 36 hours to sort of get our flow going and had a fantastic experience. After we finished the big long, the first bike section, we were heading off into a night section, which was one of the biggest climbs of the race, Faroe Islands. Every climb was big. And Dave, who had all that mountaineering experience, we were in the parking lot after the transition area was over, and we were heading towards the beginning of this massive climb. And he had all that experience, and he talked about how, okay, guys, like, this is what we're going to do now. Like, we're keeping a steady pace. We're not going to go anaerobic. We're going to make steady climb up this mountain here. By him setting that expectation prior to the climb, we didn't have to worry about, are we going fast enough? Are we going slow enough? Like, just steady forward progress is what was necessary here. But he was wise enough to make that call prior to being ourselves on the mountain. And I think that for those who are home listening to the podcast, who may want to dive into a Rev 3 race, may want to looking at level up with a 50-hour race, with your teammates, have those conversations away from the intensity of the experience. That's the way you have to do it. Otherwise, you're asking for trouble.
Exactly. And exactly. That's fantastic. It reminds me of a time in the Expedition Canada race. We were coming off a whitewater paddle section. It was maybe 3 a.m. and we had individuals that were starting to fall asleep on the paddle. We had a big bike leg coming up, and being asleep on the bike is dangerous. So part of the team wanted to push, and the captain and I were like, no, this is too dangerous. We want to stay. The captain did a great job, which is Ben, of listening to each individual and then making a decision as the team captain. And once he made the decision, everybody went with it, you know? And so generally your captain's the most experienced individual, but they also have to be somebody that can make those fair judgments and has that personality, which works well. And so, yeah, definitely the risk mitigation piece and having those conversations prior to, and just expectations on what you want. So for example, I'm racing with the Royal Elks in Ecuador. We're doing, I think, Raid of the Rockies prior. However, we had a talk before they invited me on the team about what are the expectations with the race. And so we're just very clear on what our expectations are. You know, we're going to go out there, we're going to have fun, we're going to push, but we're not going to, you know, try to do anything that's going to destroy the experience for anybody.
When you say Ecuador, do you mean Worlds?
Yep.
Oh, you're going to love it. Absolutely. Santiago has been on the show. I've done his races before. Anybody who's listening and considering Worlds, absolutely do that race. You'll have an outstanding. Have you raced in Ecuador before?
No,
you're going to love it. Love it. Fantastic country. So much fun. Great place for world championships. Good hands with Santiago. I'm excited to, I'm not going to be able to go to that race. I'm excited to talk about that race and see how it goes down there, because that's going to be a really, really good race. Really good race. And so, yeah, and we'll talk about a lot today. Talk a lot about the races that are going on with Rev3, your experience. Talk to me a bit about like your in-race, and it's, I get granular on this, but the audience likes it. Your in-race nutrition. Are you a real food guy? You're a goo guy? You're a mixture? What do you like?
I love candy. I love candy, but the longer the race is, the more you need whole foods. Yeah. So, I like a meatball sub sometimes. I'll pack like half a meatball sub, and 6 hours into the race, for whatever reason, I'll destroy a meatball
sub. It's like
magic. Yeah. If it's one of the races where you have a TA bin, but you don't quite need one, I'll put some blueberries in there, and just fresh blueberries are great. I saw Ben at Canada. He had some avocados and cheese, which was a pretty cool option. You know, some fats, a little heartier. And Uncrustables are great. A lot of people are doing cheeseburgers now. So I'd say whole food is fantastic and probably your best option. But getting things that you can just eat no matter what are good. At the end of the day, calories are calories at points. And so for me, if I generally eat very healthy. So when I race, I can have some candy and it's like a treat for me. But the longer the race is, the more I need those whole foods.
Yeah, the joke usually is I asked a racer one time what their favorite race food is. And they said, whatever's in my teammates' pack.
Yeah.
They enjoy eating their teammates' food. And you're right about the idea of the hamburgers. I know the secret magic race food are McDonald's hamburgers, because they last for a long time, and they're salty, bad, good food to have. So you're right about that. I mean, staying on top of your food. But I do agree with you. I found I'm a big Spring Energy guy. Spring Energy, not a sponsor of the Dark Zone, so I could talk about them at will. This is not pay to play. They do a really nice job because they're lower in sugar. They don't eat your mouth up. Because nothing's at the end of a race, the sores you get in your mouth from having all the sugar go through is really, really, it's a challenge. Also, I remember we were day three in Scotland, might have been day four, and my teammate had a fresh carrot. And it was like the great, it was like brushing your teeth. It was like the greatest thing in the world. And so I do agree. I think that that's a big part of it too. But the big thing with the nutrition we've learned over time is it's specific to everybody. So know what you can eat, know what you can't eat, and be ready for that.
Exactly. And there's some good meta-analysis showing that the gut microbiome, so it's all the organisms in your intestines that digest the food, the species you have there, the biodiversity will differ up to 30% from individual to individual. And when you think like genetically, there's only 2% difference between us and like, you know, apes. I mean, there's a very large difference. And so the way in which you digest is different person to person.
And I think also nutritional needs. Like I know one racer who, you know, they get into a transition area and the idea of eating is just like, they can't eat right away. They have to walk around a little bit, where some other teammates just eat right away. Right. They'll go right to the bin and start eating. Someone, I have to set a little bit my, you know, and you know this better than I do, in high intensity exercise, it's tougher to digest food because all of the energy is going to your extremities to power your body. So your stomach kind of shuts down. Am I using the right terminology there?
Correct. Yeah. So you'll have, you have two sides of your body, of your nervous system. You have your somatic, which is kind of moving body parts, or like, you know, I'm moving my fingers right now or mm-hmm. running. And then you have your autonomic nervous system, which is kind of the aspect that controls two parts, your fight, flight, and free side, and your rest, digest, relax side, sympathetic, parasympathetic, or the opposite. And when you do super high intensity, really when you turn anaerobic, you turn on that sympathetic nervous system, that fight, flight, freeze. Your body will divert blood from your intestines out to your muscles. And so that way there's more oxygen there. It also increases the amount of glycogen stores and the amount of glucose that goes into the bloodstream to fuel the muscles for that. However, you're not able to digest as well. So if you can calm your heart rate down and for a long period of time, you kind of switch over into that more parasympathetic side, which is relaxing and more digestion, and you can eat more. So the higher your heart rate is, the harder it is to digest food. So one thing you could do is if you're coming into a transition is maybe slow down a little bit leading into it for a mile, you know, talk through what your transition is going to be, but allow the heart rate to come down. And with that, the intensities are different. So we may be going together on the bike at the same speed, and then your heart rate, you know, might be at 140, mine might be at 180. And it's different. The other aspect to know is the higher the heart rate is, the more sugars you burn. So the more carbohydrate, glycogen, glucose stores you're burning, which are limited. So your body can only store maybe around like 1600 calories worth. And if it burns it unsustainably, you're going to start to lose out. And that's where that bonk comes in. And so your gut can only actually intake around 150 to 300 calories worth of carbohydrate per hour. And so if you're going really hard, really fast, you're going to be burning that and you burn it ineffectively. When you're going aerobically, you actually burn the carbohydrates way more efficiently, meaning you're going to get, I think it's like 30, no, you're going to get about 10 times the amount of energy out of a gram of carbohydrate when you are aerobic versus anaerobic. So going anaerobic burns your glycogen very rapidly, and you get a lot less energy out of it. Whereas when you're going at a lower heart rate and aerobically, that's going to last a lot longer. Also, when your heart rate's lower, you're burning more of your energies coming from fat stores. And we have all of us, even you know, skinny individuals have, you know, 25,000 to 100,000 calories worth of fat on them. And so you can burn that fat and the carbohydrate aerobically and go for a lot longer, and it's sustainable. So as you're eating, you can continue. So if you're in a short race, you push for that heart rate. But one aspect I see on teams is where they're pushing and the weakest individual is at a super high heart rate and they bonk and then bounce back because they're pushing too hard too long. Whereas really you need to slow down more and help that individual along. So towing early, drafting early, keeping on top of the nutrition, all those things are going to help. And you really should be kind of where that lower individual is. Another piece of advice when you have a variety of intensities within the team is you should not have your navigator be somebody whose modality you're doing is their weak spot, because their heart rate's going to be higher. They're not thinking as clearly. They're more likely to make a mistake. So if you have multiple navigators, switching the navigator helps with that cognitive load. However, you know, if when I'm with Dave Ashley, he's biking, he's a stronger biker, he's navigating. If we're on foot, I can always take over that because I'm stronger on foot, right? Or I can rabbit and then we keep him slower. But those are just some different techniques that you can use kind of with the physiology in mind.
Holy cow. Clearly, you know your stuff. I feel like, is this going to be on the test? I mean, thank you for that, for the class and how that worked. Yeah, that was perfect.
It's multiple choice. You can go on the show notes.
As long as it's open book. And so I could feel the listeners kind of eating up what you're talking about. So two things, I have a question there. One is, mm-hmm. when you smell ammonia after a hard workout, is that when you begin to burn through muscle?
Correct. Yep. So when I was in Ranger school, for example, it's normally 60 something days. I decided to do mountain phase twice, which is not recommended. So I was there for about 80 something. We're eating 1,000 to 1,200 calories a day. And you're just carrying 80, 100 pound packs doing combat operations in the mountains and swamps and all over for days on end. And you're not sleeping. Like you're sleeping 0 to 2 hours a night. And so, sleep deprivation's huge, but really you're in such a caloric deficit. A couple weeks in, your skin and bones and your muscles going. So the ammonia comes from proteins. So you hear amino acids, it means with nitrogen. And carbohydrates and fats are both carbohydrates, or carbon, hydrogen, oxygen make up fat and carbohydrate. And the body can take excess sugar, turn it into fat, can take fat, turn it into carbs, because they're very similar, right? Whereas protein is nitrogen based and it has its own entire system. So, you know, people, you might read stuff about creatine kinase in the urine after exercise because of muscle breakdown. If you eat too much protein, that'll come out, which is fine. You really can't eat too much protein if you're a healthy individual. However, it's all that amino acids. And so the ammonia is nitrogen based, and having that excess nitrogen and burning it and consuming it is what causes that ammonia smell.
People racing in very, very hot conditions, their stomach shut down because mm-hmm. they're, and I'm assuming the stomach shuts down because I'm going to guess, and correct me there, Professor, that because the stomach, the body fluid that is used to digest is being pushed to the extremities to cool the body off.
So your correct. Stomach shuts down?
Yes.
I knew I did that one right. Yep. The blood flow goes to the surface of the skin to try to dissipate the heat.
And as a result, your stomach shuts down.
Correct. Yeah. And then if you're dehydrated, it's harder to eat the food too. So for example, one molecule of glycogen requires 4 molecules of water. And so for storage. And so when you're eating carbs, you need to be drinking water as well. And when you're dehydrated, it's harder to eat, which you can tell, yeah. You know, it's, your mouth is dry. It's very difficult to eat.
Yeah. And if people, and the idea, like if you're deep into a race and if it's a long time with no water and you have that devil's bargain in your head because you know you're not thirsty, you're very, very thirsty and you're not hungry because there's your body won't digest it. So you have this idea like, I got to get some water in me. I have to replenish my system fluid based and then I put food on top of it. And so I'm assuming that like the more, I'll use the term watery, not really the right word to use, the more fluid based gels, they tend to go down better because they're less thicker on the way in. So your body is a little bit easier to digest in your stomach.
Does that sound right?
Okay.
Yep. You're nailing it.
Okay. When someone is not racing, right. And out there the 30% gut biome thing is really fascinating, right? The idea that there's such a variance in what works for different people. And I have no desire to get into the vegetarian versus the vegan versus the meat-based. That's a different podcast for a different mm-hmm. person. In generally speaking, when someone is inside a big training cycle, mm-hmm. calorie replenishment is obviously important, right? Because you're expending calories through training. You got to feed the body to re-energize the body to then be able to train again. What, generally speaking, is the best method through which to replenish the body? Is it meat protein? Is it fruits and veggies? Is it a variety of sources? Like what has your experience shown you to be more successful?
Yeah, it's kind of just a well-rounded diet. And so to go into it, you have a couple different buckets. So your dense carbohydrates, if you need extra calories because you're really training hard, that's kind of your main fuel source. So carbohydrates come from plants, fruits and vegetables are considered those, but you don't get a lot of carbs in those exactly. You need those fruits and vegetables because they have a lot of antioxidants, which help to combat, it's called oxidative stress, but the stress in the body, those help with it. You also get a lot of vitamins and minerals and phytochemicals in that are important, and the fiber, which is huge. So fruits and vegetables, you need a lot of. If you need more energy than that because you're training, then adding in those other carbohydrates like the pastas, rices, quinoa, all of those things are phenomenal and really kind of a go-to. So that's fueling your training. Proteins help to repair the body. So they'll repair your muscles as well as your tendons and ligaments. And getting those into you is important as well. And so there's a difference between animal-based proteins and plant-based proteins. So you have amino acids, which are just what protein is comprised of. So you have all these different strands you probably hear about, like leucine and all these different ones. And they have all different strands that come together and they're called protein. Your body needs to consume those in order to heal itself. Some the body makes on its own, but for these ones that are called non-essential amino acids, for essential amino acids, those are ones that the body cannot produce on its own. when you eat plants, you typically need to eat a variety of plants that have protein in them in order to get all the different kinds in. Whereas for animal-based products or animal-based proteins, they have all of them packed into any type of animal-based. So if you are going on the vegetarian side or the vegan side, you need to be careful about making sure you're getting a variety of types of protein into your diet. The pea proteins and soy proteins are pretty whole-ish. And then there's a whole variety that you can do as well in order to mix it and try to get all of those in. And then separately, just one difference between those is your iron intake. So iron is found in a lot of animal products and meats. However, it's also found in plants. The difference, though, is that your body digests the iron more efficiently from animal than it does from plants. So often you see vegetarian and vegan athletes having an iron deficiency. So you can check your blood work, and likely a endurance athlete who's a vegetarian or vegan will benefit from an iron supplement, but you do need to be careful with that. So in general, talk to your provider, but just know that's likely an issue you may encounter. And then the last thing are really the healthy fats. And so fats, you kind of got healthy, unhealthy. In general, a lot of your animal-based fats are generally a little bit more on the unhealthy side. Your plant-based fats, like your nuts, legumes, avocados, oils, nut butters, those things are really your healthy fats, just to kind of keep it very simple. And ingesting those is very important. It helps with really your hormone function and being able to digest certain types of vitamins. So you'll have fat soluble vitamins. And so you need your healthy fats, you need your proteins, and you need your carbs and fruits and vegetables kind of all mixed in. In general, if I was trying to make it simple, there's a lot of apps out there you can download to track your stuff. One is calculate your caloric intake, and you can estimate it. You can find online calculators. I like one called Harris Benedict. It's not the most accurate, but if you go to omnicalculator.com and go to the Harris Benedict, what this calculator will do is you can click on PAL, physical activity level, and you can click on how intense your exercise is through the week. And it gives you kind of descriptions of what it is, and you can guess. And then with, you know, all the other factors there, it makes it very simple to know what your caloric need is. Then you can download any kind of apps, Chronometer, MyFitnessPal are two popular ones. And from there, it'll help you calculate out what your macronutrients are. So protein, carbs, and fats. And if you can get very close to your caloric need, as well as your protein, carbs, and fats, you're doing really well. And then separate, make sure your fiber is good. So you can easily hit all those buckets, but if your fiber is really low, it's likely not a healthy diet. So the fourth thing I add is fiber, and then just a multivitamin. And that's a very simple way that can get you to a very, very, like, you know, 85% solution, 90% solution on a diet that you can do yourself.
So, thank you for that. I mean, I could feel people hitting the re-listen button and listening to it a few times, because a lot of information for them to absorb.
Yeah.
There, and the references to those apps are great. Recognizing that variety is essential for a body system to work effectively. You mentioned the proteins, the fats, the fruits, the veggies, the meats, all those, that variety is necessary, even where you get your protein from. Is there anything that you say to athletes, you really shouldn't consume that? Like you can eat whatever you want, but I don't recommend that you put that in your body.
Fried foods. Yeah. Fried foods they're like poison. What I would say is, so for example, French fries, right? I love French fries. But if I cut them up and bake them, they're going to be way healthier than deep frying them. And so when you go out, I would say consistency is key, and the little decisions add up. But once in a while, having something is fine, right? So if you have, you know, okay, once a week eating this, right? Something unhealthy, whatever it is, that's okay. Or if I have a couple little unhealthy things, my caloric intake's high, that's okay. If the bulk of what I'm eating, if 95% of what I'm eating is generally pretty healthy, most of the time I'm going out eating relatively healthy options, then those couple times here and there that I don't, it doesn't really matter because I'm super consistent. Right. And so you need something that's sustainable. So I'll go out and have a burger and fries from time to time, and that's fine.
Right.
Because the bulk of my meals through the week are very healthy and the snacks are healthy. And so that's kind of just a general trend.
Yeah, you touched on it, the idea of the 95-5. I was always taught, and by the way, you're the expert. Feel free to tell me I'm as wrong as you want. You won't offend me one bit. I've worked under the assumption that if 95% of your diet is reasonable and healthy, the other 5% can be whatever you want it to be. That's roughly where I've the problem with that is that sometimes we all kind of mix up that dynamic, and you have a salad on a Tuesday and you're like, I'm good. And you have your fourth slice of pizza on a Friday. Like that's not a good idea. First off, thank you for the expanse of so many topics we covered today. So much good stuff out there. Mm-hmm. I love the fact we're highlighting the races that you're directing. I love the adaptive sports AR that you're putting on. Really want to cast a spotlight on the good work that you're doing. Is there anything that I didn't bring up today that you really wanted to talk about?
Oh, actually, can you re-mention about the organization that you had on the podcast before who's helping with a lot of the female athletes?
Ascend Athletics. Yes.
I'd love to talk about that a little bit. To re-hit what they do. What they do is fantastic.
Yeah. So Marina Legree, I sponsor them, I guess, so to speak, by giving them attention during the podcast. Marina Legree and her team basically worked, Ascend Athletics worked in Afghanistan and Pakistan with women in terms of women empowerment. And, there are dynamics in those countries that are tilted against women and having them grow as people. And they look at outdoor based education, climbing, getting in the mountains as a sense of empowerment, right? What we talked about earlier, the fact that you get by doing things that are challenging, you grow as a person and you get better seeing that the light come on in somebody's eyes. And that's what Marina and her team does. And so the Dark Zone is happy to give them time in the beginning of every episode. We mentioned who they are. And I always like to point out that they don't pay a dime for that sponsorship. I would never think to charge them. They have an event that is coming up, and I'll put it in the show notes, in June, I believe, called Hike With Her. That is going to be a day of women's empowerment as a hiking fest in Western Virginia. And so I'll put that into the show notes. And so we love the fact that they do that and we get to support them. And I do know that they're looking to put together a team of former, they used to live in Afghanistan and Pakistan. They've now relocated to America and they want to bring them into an adventure race. So we're looking to find a race for them to do over the course of the next several months.
Yeah, I'll give them free entry to any of the Rev races this year.
I'll definitely. There you go. So, Marina, if you're listening, guess what?
Yeah.
And I think that's and they do great, great work. And I think, I appreciate you bringing them up and I appreciate you making it a point to mention them, because if you think about it, between the work that you're doing, working with the community in terms of the races you're putting on, the adaptive sports we're putting on there, the fact that Marina is working with a population in need there, that adventure racing in many ways tries really hard to be a big tent. And we want to bring as many people as we can into the sport along the way. And if there's gaps in what we're doing, those gaps should be called out and we should do our best to close those gaps. But I love being part of a community that is trying to put all those things together over time, and alongside helping people be the best version of themselves, right? And doing a lot of fun stuff. And so I appreciate you bringing up Marina and her and Ascend's work while we're sitting here chatting today.
Yeah, my pleasure. When I listened to that podcast story, it blew my mind because they were talking about in 2016, they were in Afghanistan in Badakhshan. And 2015, the beginning of 2016, I was deployed there and we were running special operations with special forces teams throughout the country. And I was in the South, which is really hairy, but all my elements were really hairy things all over. But some of them were launching into Badakhshan doing combat operations there. And so there's a lot of nefarious activity in that area, and they're there leading women and empowering women in these phenomenal outdoor adventures. And just the fact that they were there and I had no idea, and knowing what the climate was like from my perspective, it's just a testament to how dedicated they are and just truly, truly amazing and mind-boggling. And they're willing to risk a lot to do what they believe and to help others, which is absolutely beautiful.
Literally, adventure racing means a lot to you. This kind of lifestyle means a lot to you. Close us out. Take the last several minutes. Tell us a bit about your own hopes for the sport. What direction you want us to grow?
I think just growing the sport to get more people involved is the best thing. I think that we will see a growth in youth entering into the sport. So typically we see individuals, mid-20s to mid-70s racing. I think the work that Jesse Tubbs is doing with Grit Adventure Racing and others, I think we're going to see a lot more youth coming into the races. And I think we're going to see more of that youth culture spreading. I know here in New Jersey, we're seeing more mountain biking high school teams arriving. Nika. And so I think we're going to see more of kind of these outdoor communities growing in younger individuals. Kind of the Boy Scouts used to do a lot of that. They're starting to fade away, unfortunately, a little bit. However, I think we're going to see more of the youth coming in, and we're going to see the sport really growing. And I think that's exciting.
Well, that's it, folks. Another episode of The Dark Zone, episode 92, I think, by my count. Who knows? They're getting up there. Thanks for being a listener. Thanks to Nick for coming on to the show. Great stuff. Love how he's so involved in the sport, what he loves doing. Good training, good fun, good coaching. Be sure to check him out over at Rev3 Adventures. Thanks for being a listener. Thanks for being here. Go to your streaming platform of choice and like and click and subscribe. The algorithm loves that. Go out there, be safe. You keep training and we'll keep talking. Correction, you keep racing and we'll keep talking. We knew we'd get it right. All right, folks, be safe.